As we drove up that little winding road past that giant hundreds of years old white pine tree up there in Jefferson, New Hampshire, we noticed that there were a lot of trees that were clear on each side of the road. And we know that it's not like Greg Gordon to cut trees down if they don't need to be cut down. And we found out that they had fallen down because of the storm. And then we looked at the buildings, and saw the tremendous damage that was done. It was tens of thousands of dollars worth of damage to the roofs and to the structural integrity of at least two of the buildings. And one asks oneself, why did the Lord allow tens of thousands of dollars worth of damage to a buildings where the Lord is in a very clear way, in a very obvious way served because of that retreat center? And of course, we understand we live in a fallen world. We live in a fallen world full of dangers and risks, and they are all around us in everything that we do. Every time I drive back home down Pine Street, I try to make sure that I remember to put my seatbelt on, because we have almost been broadsided many, many times on these one-way streets. Life is full of risks, and we never know when something, even though we do the best that we can to prevent them, something difficult, something bad, something dangerous, harmful, or even deadly will happen to us. And it's those unpredictable things that, partly anyway, which are taken up here in the first section, but then in the whole of this section, we see again this great theme, and he does it in great detail now, takes it up in great detail in order to really make it stick with us, that with all that we can do to prevent disasters, and we should do them, we can never ultimately control our lives. And then, so that we don't despair in the midst of this mixed and dangerous, this risky world in which we live, the Lord really, in a very subtle way here, through these words, encourages us to trust in Him. Because He, verse 5 of chapter 11, and this is one of the main themes of the book, He knows what's going on because He is the one who works everything. And so, let's go back now and look at some of these dangers which he enumerates in the everyday world. Our wacky world is just full of dangers, and we can probably each identify, even though this comes from the ancient world where some of these things are not done by many today, but we can identify with some of these risks. And of course, they're simply symbolic of all the risks that we take in our everyday lives. And so we look in verse 8 then at the one that digs a pit will fall into it. This is the hunter who digs a trap, and he covers it to keep it from the sight of the animals he's trying to trap. And yet there's a risk that he'll forget where it is and he'll fall into it. And these things happen. And then there's something maybe more familiar to New Englanders who have stone walls, that the snake will bite him who breaks. And here it's not breaks through, really. It's really to take apart a wall. And I don't know that you've ever done this or not, but I build stone walls, so I haven't encountered snakes. But apparently out in the country, where there are stone walls that have been there for maybe centuries, snakes will get into the stone walls. And I'm not sure if poisonous ones are there in New Hampshire. We know timber rattlers tend to hide in brush. But in any case, if you're taking it apart, one of the risks is that you're going to get bit. And that happens. It happened in the ancient world. Or he who quarries stones may be hurt by them. And incidentally, the word will here, I don't know why none except the NIV got the translation in the probable tense. It should be probable. It may hurt you. It may. It's the mood. It may hurt you, but then again, it may not. So it's not it will, because it's not a certainty. That's the whole point of this chapter. Only the NIV, for some reason, gets that right. But that is the point that he is making here. And if you've seen, I was just talking with Tim Sharp this morning about quarrying stone up in the great quarries near Swenson Granite up in Concord. And he was saying, if you've ever seen it, it's really interesting because the blades, which are huge, have to be cooled with water because they're so hot. And you're dealing with stones that weigh tons. I've just had some field stone put into my backyard. And, you know, it's just this big bunch of them, but it weighs 2.5 tons. Very easy to hurt yourself with stone. And again, you may hurt yourself. You might not, but the probability is there, or the possibility. And then finally, he who splits logs is endangered by them. And anyone who's ever done any wood cutting, either with a chainsaw or splitting with a splitting maul, knows how easily you can hurt yourself, and hurt yourself actually quite badly. And so, there it is. It's danger. And so, but then, someone might say, well, you know, why bother? We live in such a risky world. And then there's a little punchline here in verse 10. If the iron is blunt and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength. So there's something we can do about it. And incidentally, it's dangerous if you don't sharpen your instruments. People would think, gee, if it's real sharp, it's going to be more dangerous, right? Wrong. Because if it's really sharp, a knife or a hatchet or a splitting maul will do its work better, more efficiently, more cleanly. And if you're not really having to really whack that wedge, you're more likely not to get hurt. And so the writer of Proverbs is saying, we live in a risky world, but God has given us wisdom at a certain practical level. And so use your noggin. Pay attention to what you're doing. Don't, just because there are risks, fail to put your seatbelt on. This is something that God is recommending through Q here. But then he adds this interesting note. And notice that he gives us four things. Then he gives us this little piece of wisdom. And then he gives us a final example. But it has that wisdom sort of wrapped up in it. Listen to what he says. If the serpent or snake bites before it is charmed, there is no advantage to the charmer. This is a difficult verse to translate properly. But here's the idea. In fact, when I first read it, I went, what on earth does that mean? That's very mysterious. Well, think about it. You're charming a snake, and everyone's at least seen this in a movie where the cobra is being charmed, and you know, you have this wonderful exotic music, and the cobra is going like this, and suddenly if something goes wrong and the charmer misses a note, he can immediately bite the person. Well, what this is saying is some snakes won't be charmed. And the word for charmer here is someone who is a master of words. So there's more to this one than meets the eye. But he's saying that there are some snakes that you can't charm them, and it's going to bite you. And there's nothing you can do about it. So what he's saying is that there are some situations where you can absolutely have no control over the danger. And no amount of talk, however good at talking you may be, is going to make any difference. So that's the world in which we live. The same world in which Q lived. And so he's warning us that while there's something that we can do, there are no guarantees that something bad will not happen to us because we live in a fallen world. Remember, if you go back and look at the number of times in Ecclesiastes up to this point, he uses the phrase under the sun. And remember, that's not just to be in the everyday world, but it's to be in the everyday world under God's wrath and curse. And the fact is that in Eden, there was no possibility that Adam could cut himself with an axe. That didn't exist. There were no risks. There was only the danger of betraying God and breaking loyalty by picking the fruit, the one fruit that he had forbidden. And so, we need to be careful then not to make it sound like we know what we're talking about when we predict the future. And that's what he deals with from 12 through 15. And talks now, he's picking up on this thing of the master of words from the charmer. And then 12 through 15, he talks about the way that fools and wise people use words. And he's saying that the wise person will win favor. That's normally the way it works. And he's already told us before this that there are times when the wise person gets smacked for no good reason, because we live in a fallen world where there is injustice. But ordinarily, the words of the wise man will win favor. But the lips of a fool will destroy him. That's what he's saying. And then he goes on to say the beginning of his words, that is the fool, in his mouth are foolishness. And the more he talks, the end of his talk is evil madness. It just gets worse. And he starts talking crazy and does great damage with his words. And then he goes on to say the fool multiplies his words. And though no man knows what is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him? And so you can picture now the fool is going on and saying, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and everything's going to turn out great and I've got my pension and everything's figured out. I'm in great health. I exercise, take all the vitamins that I need to. He's a fool. And the writer is saying there's no guarantee of what is going to happen after him. And he's foolish for thinking that he knows. Reminds us, doesn't it, of James 4. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go in such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. Precisely the point of the writer of Ecclesiastes. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. How different that is from the arrogance of the fallen person. The modern world, in that respect, is quite like this ancient world where fools abound. Then the second major point here, verses 16 to 20, is that our wacky world is not only full of everyday dangers, but is full of political dangers. I got on this list where I constantly get these little notices of certain meetings of conservative Republicans here in town, and every once in a while there's an alert, there's some bill that's going to bring disaster upon America or New Hampshire or whatever, and some of them bring small disasters, to be sure, and maybe all of them at once will bring great disasters, but there's the sense there in all of that that if only we can elect the right people, everything will be just hunky-dory. Well, in fact, we ought to try to elect good people, people of integrity, people who have good principles of statesmanship, people that understand what it is that government is for. It's meant to preserve life in order to bring some justice, to keep society livable, to make it a place where people can actually live and maybe even, to a degree, prosper. And so we have this contrast then in verses 16 and 17, which really it reflects the mix that we see in politics by giving us the two poles. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. And then happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of the nobility and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. Now, remember what we said about nobility last Lord's Day. Nobility is a good thing here. We in our egalitarian democratic society think, nobles, that's what we did away with when we decided on a constitutional republic and a democracy. But here, the understanding was, and I think we probably need to pay more attention to this in our own culture, that someone who was raised in a noble family knew how to manage big things. And so it was a good thing. The king is a son of a noble, and we see the line of kings in Judah, for example, especially where kings knew how to rule, and of course some of them fell into idolatry and corruption, and that's the other side. That's verse 16. And so there's this mixed situation. He's really saying, woe to the land when this happens, and blessed is the land when this happens. We have good rulers, but it's recognizing that we have both. Now, again, wisdom says that we ought to do everything within our power they didn't elect people, so to respect the good, to pray for the good, to wish for the good, to to do everything you can to make sure that things are run well politically. But when you can't, there's not much you can do except pray that the Lord will intervene. The fact is, and of course we can vote, there are things in a democracy, in God's providence, that we can do, but that's not really the point here. The point is that you don't have ultimate control over these things, and especially in a monarchy you didn't, because the son of a king became the king. Nothing you could do about that at all. And in fact, if we will admit it, there's not as much as we sometimes think that we can do about politics. But guess what? God is in control. We aren't, but God is in control. Notice, just as an aside, that the idea of having a child to be your king was a curse. That is, the cult of youth, the worship of youth is a curse. I think Plato, though he didn't have a lot of things right, he had one thing right, and that's that in order to be part of the ruling class, you had to at least be 50 years of age. That let out a lot of people. And we have an age limit for president of the United States. And it's a wise thing. It's not a good thing when people with no experience, who may think that they know more than they do, rule in a culture. And so we see the curse in Isaiah chapter 3, that when God brings judgment upon Judah, one of the things he says is, I will make boys their princes, and infants shall rule over them. It's not a good thing. Unwise things happen. Rehoboams end up taking power and doing things that work great harm. And then also notice that there are those, one of the signs of the noble prince is that he has a sense of appropriateness, and so he has a feast, but it's only to strengthen the kingdom. And he's not just having a party, which is only to have fun, to squander one's resources. And of course, this has an effect. And that's what verse 18 refers to. It's not just a haphazard proverb here. Through sloth, the roof sinks in. And through indolence, the house leaks. It's the potholes of the ancient world. And we see this. You know, one wonders. You go around and you see all the money that goes into government, and then you encounter potholes. The most fundamental thing that local and state governments ought to be doing, they often aren't doing. And one of the reasons is there's corruption there. And so this is part, again, of the fallen world in which we live. And so, be careful, because here's the punchline to this section. 19, I think, and a lot of the commentators, this is where I got this idea, and I agree with them as I've looked at the context, it probably was a drinking song. Bread is made for laughter, and wine gladdens the life, and money answers everything, and that's what they would sing. And the corrupt politicians or kings or princes would sing this song, and that's the way they lived. So the things that really needed work in the culture, they collapsed. And then listen to verse 20. Here's the punchline for us. One might say, ah, politics, what good is it? I hate those kings and princes, those corrupt statesmen. They're just an awful bunch. Be careful, because there's a spy lurking somewhere in your life who's going to tell them. Now, I once lived in Madrid, Spain, when Franco was the king, and he was a dictator. And they had, it was kind of scary for an American. I'm just not used to this kind of culture. And I can remember, I asked my host, who was putting me up for a few months while I helped him with some teaching, and I asked him, in the apartment that we were living in, I said, tell me about Franco. He said, shh. Because Franco has little birds that listen, and they bring messages. And you can get into great trouble. It's a warning of the danger of a corrupt prince or king may do you great harm. So be respectful, because God has put him there too for his own purposes, even though he may do wicked things. Titus 3, remind them to be submissive to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one. See, he knows the temptation to speak evil of dignitaries, to avoid quarreling, to be gentle, to show perfect courtesy towards all people. That's the picture of what the Christian ought to do, whether the government is good or bad. And then the third point, and this is the first six verses of chapter 11, is that despite these dangers in politics and in everyday life, exercise wisdom in a wacky world. Do your duty and trust God in the midst of it all. And so in verses 1 and 2, he says, be generous while you can. Now, there is great controversy over these verses. Some commentators feel that cast your bread upon the waters means invest your money wisely. But I don't think so. I think what he's talking about, though investing your money wisely is a good thing to do, but he's speaking here of the unexpected consequences of doing good while you can. And verses 1 and 2 have to be taken together. He says, then give a portion to 7 or even 8. In other words, help others. And 7 or 8 would be a lot of people to help at one time. There may even be some symbolism there. The Sabbath perfection of 7. And then 8 is going beyond that to the new creation. Several commentators suggested that, though I wouldn't want to press that. But here is clearly the idea that while before disaster happens to you, the end of verse 2, do good. Do good now. You may be dead tomorrow. You may go to be with the Lord tomorrow. Serve Him today in whatever situation you find yourself. And of course, this is where Galatians 6, 7 through 10 comes in. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever one sows, that he will also reap. So you cast your bread upon the waters. It looks like squandering. Oftentimes, as we give our money to the church and 10% or more of our income, the world looks at that, and I'm amazed that we don't get tagged by the IRS. They probably have a way of labeling us as OPC or PCA, or, you know, Reformed Christians or fundamentalists who tithe. So this is normal for these people when you see it on their tax returns. But the fact is that most of the world would look at this and say, what a waste. We could be out having fun right now. Why are you wasting your time and your money by giving in this way? And yet, we will not see until eternity the fruit of what we have sown in gospel ministry. And this includes, of course, being generous with helping people who need food in the refrigerator or who have some other financial, some temporal need. But notice now what he relates it to in Galatians 6. He says, for one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. But one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life. So there he's talking about using our resources to in gospel ministry and in the power of the Spirit doing good to our own souls, and but especially to those around us. Because he goes on to say, and let us not grow weary of doing good. It's easy to do that when we do good. We can get weary, we can get tired and say, how many more needs can I meet? He says, don't do that, for in due season you will reap. It may not be till the judgment that you find that that person in a far away place that the missionary spoke to and we helped in a small way to fund their being there, that they spoke to someone about the gospel, and because of that, they will be in eternity. What seemed like squandering money will come back in a wonderful, wonderful way. And so then as we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, and especially to those who are of the household of faith. I missed something, and that is, for in due season you will reap if you do not give up. Don't give up. Never stop doing good while you have life, while you have breath. How many people on their deathbed have said, oh, if only I had done more good, if only I had given more of what God gave me. And so the writer Paul of Galatians is saying, give now. And so is Q in the book of Ecclesiastes. Paul in 2 Corinthians, as he is encouraging the Corinthians in terms of their temporal giving to support his ministry as well as the famine-stricken church in Jerusalem, he says, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must give as he has made up his mind, not reluctantly or under compulsion, but God loves a cheerful giver. What's the reason for being cheerful? Paul tells us in the next, at the end of the chapter, thanks be to God for his inexpressible gift. It's Christ who makes us cheerful, because in Christ is the perfection of humanity which has saved us, because he is also God who calls us to be his new people, his new creation, and we will with him spend eternity. It's by his grace that we have been saved, and so his indescribable gift, it goes beyond what human words can thank him for or even describe. That's the reason why we should be motivated to help those for whom he has given his life. And then verses 3 to 5, very interesting verses here. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if the tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. So he's describing now the courses of nature and the weather. And then he takes the farmer now and he says, listen, this is a problem. He who observes the wind will not sow. He who regards the clouds will not reap. Here he's not saying, watch the weather and plant wisely, but this is where caution cripples. We're so cautious, and we see this in the modern world. In the extreme situation, there are people who are so paranoid about risking their lives by going out their door that they stay in almost a catatonic state in their homes. They never leave their homes. That's how bad fear can be. There's a lot of that in our culture, but it's always been in the world. And the writer here is saying, if you try to compensate for risk to such a degree that it stops you from planting, you're dead. Don't do this. This is no way to live. The fact that there are risks in a fallen world shouldn't stop you. And then look what he says. Here again, we see this pattern of a number of proverbs, proverbial truths, and then he makes a point and gives us a final proverb or exhortation as a result. And so here's the point, and it's one of the main points of the book. As you do not know the way the Spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child. That's interesting. We know when, just like we can look, and there's a play on words here in verse 3, when the clouds are full of rain, that's mysterious. Even more mysterious is when a woman's womb is full of baby. That's really the play on words that you see here in the Hebrew. And what a mysterious thing that a baby grows and bones and muscle and brain and spirit, ruach, the breath there that gives life to this new being that grows inside of a woman. It's amazing. It's mysterious. And ask any physician, ask anyone who works in the medical industry, and then more importantly, ask a mom or a dad who has seen a birth and has children. It's a miracle in a sense, in a broad sense. It's mysterious. And that's the point here. Can you understand it? No. We can control certain things, and we're thankful for the medicine that we have and the skill of physicians. We're thankful for that. It's like sharpening your axe. It's a good thing to do. But do we fully understand it? Do we have complete control? Not at all. And so he goes on to say, and this is a big punchline, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. So he's saying, don't try to understand it. Where there's mystery, leave it in God's hands. It's not leaving it nowhere. It's not a counsel of despair or cynicism, but it's saying, God knows what you don't. And then the biggest message of all in Ecclesiastes, be content with him, with his control, with his blessings, and with his cursings, with the risks and the disasters in life. Be content. God is the one who works everything, and he understands the mysteries of everything. And so then the final exhortation, a practical exhortation based on this profound theological reality. In the morning, sow your seed. In the evening, withhold not your hand, for you don't know which will prosper, this or that, whether both alike will be good. You see what he's saying? Do what God has called you to do and live trusting Him. That's the way to live. That's the way for believers to live, knowing the risks, taking all necessary precautions, but trusting Him ultimately, knowing that God in Jesus Christ has saved you for all eternity. And so in the interim, in this pilgrim situation, we should live trusting Him and being content with the way that He deals out our lives to us, because He has His own glory, but wrapped up in that, our own blessing and salvation at heart. Those are the things that He is paying attention to, and He knows best how to bring these things to pass. And so it is then, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto the Lord.